This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, as climate change tightens its grip on the world, Bangladesh says it's running out of time.
In my lifetime, I have seen 3 floods striking us every 5 years. But now, we are living in situations where we are facing floods every day.
Countries across the Middle East and North Africa face challenging hurdles to go green.
Arab countries no longer have a choice. This isn't about wanting to convert to a green economy or not. They have to do it. We urgently need growth on the one hand, and we have to protect the environment.
And at a gathering of creative minds in Berlin, designers tell us how they are using solar power to brighten girls' futures.
Gender has everything to do with energy, or rather, energy has everything to do with gender. The people who are living off-grid and don't have access to electricity, 70% are women and girls.
I'm Saroja Coelho, standing in for Nathan Witkop. Welcome to the show. The latest round of global climate talks is set to open in Durban, South Africa, next week. Delegates from nearly 200 governments will be joined by environmental scientists, farmers, youth leaders, and activists. The agenda is ambitious, to say the least. There's the issue of Kyoto. It's the only international treaty setting down binding limits on carbon emissions, and it expires at the end of next year. So we can expect lots of debate about what a new climate pact would look like and who's going to sign on. But the talks in Durban are also about cold, hard cash. There will be debates on who is first in line to tap a multi-billion dollar green climate fund. That money is intended to help poorer nations cope with climate change, but the details of who gets what and when have yet to be finalized. Meanwhile, Bangladesh, one of the world's most vulnerable countries to climate change, says it's running out of time. By the middle of this century, Bangladesh is likely to lose about 11% of its land. That could affect the lives of some 15 million people. Amir al-Rashid has this report from Dhaka.
Bangladesh is home to hundreds of rivers. It was once considered a country of unlimited freshwater. Its low-lying floodplains cover 80% of the country. Historically, this has been a source of enormous agricultural fertility. Today, it is also a vulnerability. Saltwater is gradually moving inland, infiltrating rivers and threatening crops. It is a major concern for locals.
In my lifetime, I have seen 3 floods striking us every 5 years. But now, we are living in situations where we are facing floods every day.
Abu Mustafa Kamaluddin is the former chief of the Department of Environment's Climate Change Cell. He says shifts in climatic conditions pose a threat to at least 30 million coastal residents as well as Bangladesh's agricultural potential.
Bangladesh is the most vulnerable country to climate change. Bangladesh is already exposed to more severe flooding, cyclonic storms, sea level rise, salinity intrusion, drought situation, and erratic precipitation behaviors that resulting into water logging into the almost all the cities, and that is actually again increasing the possibilities of more disease outbreak. The agriculture is our backbone, is seriously impacted. Disaster is happening more and more. All the infrastructures are under pressure.
Last year in Cancun, the world's rich nations agreed to mobilize $100 billion a year by 2020 for developing countries like Bangladesh. The money is supposed to help them adjust to climate change. However, details on how the so-called Green Climate Fund will work remain heavily contested. Who will control it? How will the money be spent? These are some of the top issues up for negotiation this year in Durban. Bangladesh's Forest and Environment State Minister Dr. Hassan Mahmoud says the money is desperately needed.
Adaptation is our priority, and for adaptation, we need to take many measures. For example, we need to reconstruct our coastal embankments. We need to do the river training and raising so that the carrying capacity of the rivers are increased, and thereby we can decrease the devastation of flooding and etc. We need to rehabilitate thousands of people who are mostly affected, whose livelihood is affected.
Mahmood estimates that Bangladesh alone needs to raise some $10 billion within the next 3 to 4 years. Dr. Mizan Arkhan at the North South University in Dhaka conducts a negotiation on finance with international donors. He says the money is proving difficult to find despite Western pledges of short-term financing.
If we can develop our capacity to develop fundable projects, then there is a lot of scope. Now there are many bilateral climate change-related funds, like German has got a bilateral fund, even Spain, DFID UK has got bilateral funds. We are having some funds more at bilateral level, rather than from multilateral channels, because multilateral channel funding to Bangladesh is still not yet very much forthcoming.
Outside assistance remains a distant prospect for many Bangladeshis on the coast. Zakir Kibria works for a non-governmental organization called Uttoron. It helps local find their own ways to become more resilient in the face of the climate change.
Well, lately we have been in discussion with the United Nations Development Programme. They are very interested to learn about the local people's initiatives, but we expect government and other development partners to not only come up and study this kind of local practices, but also work in general with the local communities to find indigenous practices related to changing crop patterns, water management, different kind of livelihood practices, and work with the local communities to fund them.
It's taken world leaders years to agree on the principle of climate finance. Until they can agree on how to disburse the money, self-help may be the best help for Bangladeshis on the front line of climate change. Amin al-Rashid, Deutsche Welle Radio, Dhaka, Bangladesh.
Thank you to Amin al-Rashid for that report. For decades, oil was the engine of development in the Middle East and North Africa. But the oil era is drawing to a close. Now, the region has some shining examples of environmentally friendly economies. Masdar, a project in Abu Dhabi, will be the site of a carbon dioxide neutral high-tech city. There are also projects using geothermal energy in Jordan and an increase in organic agriculture in Egypt and Lebanon. But the Arab Forum for Environment and Development says the trend isn't developing fast enough. The following report is from Mona Nagar.
Oil. In the Middle East, it means lucrative revenue, but the environmental costs are growing every year. The costs of damage to the environment done by the oil industry have reached $95 billion a year. That's about 5% of the combined gross national products of all the countries in the Arab region. According to Murad Ahmad Al-Faqih from the Organization for Environmental Protection in Yemen, environmental issues are largely overlooked within the oil industry. In fact, he's concerned that products manufactured in the Arab region will no longer be competitive if changes aren't made.
Arab countries no longer have a choice. This isn't about wanting to convert to a green economy or not. They have to do it. We urgently need growth on the one hand, and we have to protect the environment.
Experts from the Arab Forum for Environment and Development share Al-Faqih's concern. The non-governmental organization brings together environmental experts and representatives from the private and public sector from various Arab countries. This year, AFED focused on sustainable development in the Arab world. The results are shattering. If no far-reaching rethinking takes place, Arab economies will not be in a position to tackle the challenges they face in the coming decades. But how will the environment get the attention it needs in the current economic climate? Right now, the unemployment rate among young Arabs is 27%. It can't be denied that oil and gas are moneymakers. The sector makes up 55% of Saudi Arabia's GNP and 60% of Qatar's. Ibrahim Abdel Jalil is the director of the Environmental Management Program at the Arabian Gulf University in Bahrain. He says there is a lack of incentives for energy-saving measures.
Countries heavily subsidize the rates of electricity. In Saudi Arabia, for example, the state subsidizes 79% of electricity prices. That means consumers only have to carry 20% of the price. But curbing these subsidies would, of course, be a very unpopular decision. So it's shied away from. A shift in attitude has not taken place yet.
Jalil, who contributed to the AFED report, says decision makers in oil exporting countries need to start thinking green.
The demand for energy is steadily growing. So power plants are being built which are operated with fossil fuels, instead of breaking new ground. Lawmakers are not creating any basic conditions to promote alternative energy. This can't continue in the future. In our region, we have immense resources in renewable energy, which are certainly not less significant than the fossil fuels we have. We must urgently invest in researching these renewable energies.
Other sectors, like water and waste management, are also in need of new innovation that would make them sustainable. According to the AFED report, 80% of solid waste in Arab countries could be recycled, but only 5% of it is. The rest is burned or buried. Rami Sharbini, a waste specialist from the University of Cairo, says clear legal standards are urgently needed.
I direct my demands at lawmakers who have neglected to deal with the issue. The first step is to impose taxes on products that have been disposed of in a cost-intensive manner and also on packaging that could have been recycled. Producers and consumers need to be made accountable. In addition, there needs to be an intensive education campaign among the population. In recycling, for example, there are very affordable technologies available, such as composting.
The Arab Forum for Environment and Development believes the first and most important step on the path to a green economy would be raising the subsidies for fuel, electricity, and water. They say the money saved should then be earmarked for the creation of green jobs and research. Shant Sharagian, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Thank you to Mona Nagar for that report. The English version was read by Shant Sharagian. It's time now to look at some of the other environmental stories happening around the world. Here's Sarah Steffen with the Eco News.
Eco News.
Brazilian authorities fine U.S. energy giant Chevron almost $28 million in damages for oil leaking from a well off the coast of Brazil. It's the maximum fine allowed under current Brazilian law. Brazil's National Oil Agency has threatened to impose two additional fines of $28 million each on Chevron for releasing false information and for not having adequate equipment to contain the spill. There's conflicting information about the current situation of the Brazilian coast. According to Chevron, about 2,400 barrels of oil leaked into the ocean before it was able to plug the well. According to ANP, however, oil continues to seep from a 400-meter-long fracture. Two Indonesian plantation workers have been arrested for allegedly killing at least 20 endangered orangutans and monkeys. The suspects said they chased down the primates with dogs before shooting, stabbing, or hacking them to death. Reports say the man told authorities that the owners of several palm oil plantations on Borneo Island offered $100 for every orangutan and $20 for every monkey they killed. The punishment for violating Indonesia's law on national resources conservation is 5 years in prison. Indonesia is home to 90% of the orangutans left in the wild, but half of its rainforests have been lost over the past 50 years in the rush to supply the world with timber, pulp, paper, and palm oil. French anti-nuclear activists clashed with police in Normandy on Wednesday as they tried to hold up a train transporting radioactive waste to a storage site in Germany. Several hundred protesters tried to occupy the train tracks near the town of Valognes in northwestern France before being repelled by police in riot gear. Police said they had detained five people. According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources, many of Europe's animals and plants are under threat. The European Red List, a part of the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species, assessed a considerable portion of Europe's native flora and fauna, finding that a large number of mollusks, freshwater fish, and vascular plants now fall into a threatened category. Freshwater mollusks are the most threatened group assessed so far. Spengler's freshwater mussel, once widespread, now only inhabits a few rivers in France and Spain. It is currently listed as critically endangered.
That was Sarah Steffen with the Eco News. Geeks, designers, entrepreneurs, scientists, global activists, all kinds of curious minds flocked to Berlin earlier this week for the most recent edition of TED Talks. Dynamic speakers took to the stage to share their innovative ideas. Many of the talks were about energy, how to save it, use it, and find new ways to harness it. In much of the world, solar energy has remained largely untapped, the single biggest obstacle being the hugely expensive solar kits. But our correspondent, Cinnamon Nippard, caught up with two women who may have new answers.
If you're familiar with the TED franchise, you'll probably know that their talks are all about ideas worth spreading. Joining me are two of the speakers here in Berlin this week, Catherine Lucy and Daniela Schiffer. Maybe I can get you both to introduce yourselves. Briefly, Catherine, what do you do and what's your idea worth spreading?
My name's Catherine Lucy and I'm the founder of Solar Sister. Solar Sister is a social enterprise that is a green energy revolution. Using the power of women's enterprise, we are spreading solar-powered lamps, distributing them to customers in the last mile in rural Africa.
And Daniela, what's your idea worth spreading?
Well, my name is Daniela Schiffer. I'm the co-founder of Changes.com. And what we do with Changes is we invite people to produce their own energy, to use their own energy, and by that make their carbon dioxide production visible on Changes.com. And we reward people and motivate them to get active.
Catherine, I take it from the name of your company, Solar Sister, you're targeting women. Why? What's gender got to do with energy?
Gender has everything to do with energy, or rather, energy has everything to do with gender. People don't realize this, but when we're working with the base of the pyramid customer, the people who are living off-grid and don't have access to electricity, 70% are women and girls. And so from a perspective of who benefits the most when we bring in technology solutions for energy, it's women and girls who benefit. And then the other aspect is from energy prosperity, when we think about who is going to make the change, who's going to change this dynamic and bring in the solar, it's women who are the primary customers at the household level of energy products. And so it's those women that we need to touch and to get them to make the changes when they're making their purchase decisions instead of buying kerosene to buy solar products.
And how does it actually work?
It's a business in a bag. And so what we do is we set women up with a business in a bag. It's very much like the cosmetic company Avon, if you know that company, where women get a bag full of their product. In this case, it's inventory of solar products, solar lamps, cell phone chargers, radios, and other small household utility type items like that. They sell the solar products. We provide them with training and support and mentoring, marketing materials, an entire business kit right there in a bag. And they're set up to go, and they sell their products. They earn a commission on every sale, and so it's immediate economic benefit to the women who are the entrepreneurs.
And what kind of a difference has this project made so far?
We are working in Uganda, Rwanda, and South Sudan, and the real impact is on the individual level, at the transformation it makes in a person's life. To replace that kerosene, which is toxic and smoky and terrible for health and a hazard, and incredibly expensive, to replace that with an affordable solar product, families benefit immediately. Children are able to study longer at night. Women are able to cook their dinners with light that's clean and safe. The kerosene lamp is the equivalent. Women inhale the equivalent of 2 packs of cigarettes a day just from one kerosene lamp.
And what's the cost comparison between kerosene and solar energy?
Yeah. Solar lamp can be $20. Which sounds like it might be a lot of money for someone living at the base of the pyramid, but actually they're currently spending up to 30% of their income for kerosene for light alone. In $2 a week for kerosene purchase, that is the equivalent of over $100 per year. So if you think about it, one $20 investment to replace a $100 expenditure in 1 year is a pretty good economic situation.
And Daniela, you want us to change our currencies. You want a money system that's backed by the sun. How does that work?
With our devices, you will be able to produce your own energy, your own green energy with solar power. And you will be able to use this own energy too. By doing so, you do something that is enormously valuable for our society. This is, you save carbon dioxide. And therefore, we reward you on changes.com by producing and using 1 watt of energy. You can earn 1 changes credit. And this changes credit you can then redeem on our platform and with partner shops and get reductions or get prices off, get services, get other products. So what we do actually is by changing our behavior and by producing our own energy, we are creating our own currency backed by the sun.
Aren't there already a lot of solar chargers for personal devices out there on the market? I mean, what's the difference about the one that changes.com have created?
Well, actually, there are a lot of products. And when we first started and came up with the idea of changes.com, actually, we wanted to use the products being out in the market. And we had quite a lot of research and looked at the devices. And unfortunately, we were not able to find a device at a reasonable price which would fit our purposes and which I would like to sell to my community. So then we started to develop our own device. And big difference to any other device which is out there, our little charger is not only able to store the energy you produce, but it also has a technology, a patented technology, that is able to count and measure the amount of energy and with this amount of carbon dioxide you have saved. And this information is then made visible on changes.com. You can then get statistics on how much you did, and you can compare with each other, and your action becomes visible.
I think it's interesting. I mean, you both started initiatives that target people very personally to change their energy consumption. But surely individuals can only do so much. I mean, shouldn't the biggest change come from the private sector and government?
I disagree. I think the private sector and the government can only do so much, and that it's really up to individuals to make these changes and to empower people to make changes for themselves. I love the idea of your organization that is giving people a visible sign of the change that they're making and that feedback loop so that they know exactly that they have this power to do to make this change.
I would even go a step further and say we won't be able to stop climate change if we don't engage everybody and every single one of us.
Well, I've been talking with Daniela Schiffer from changes.com and Catherine Lucy from Solar Sister at TEDx Berlin. Thank you both for joining me.
Seagrasses are flowering plants that grow in meadows along the ocean floor. Posidonia oceanica is a seagrass named after the ruler of the sea, Poseidon. It's commonly known as Neptune grass, and it plays an important role in the Mediterranean ecosystem. Seagrasses provide food and habitat for a variety of ocean species, including seahorses, sea turtles, and other marine life. They also play an important role in protecting our planet from global warming. It grows in abundance around the island of Mallorca in Spain. But as our next report explains, it's being torn out and poisoned by human activity, and locals are looking to take action before it's too late. Stephanie Eichler has this report, which is read by Jesse Wingard.
Children play along the sandy beaches of the Bay of Palma. Sunbathers stand up, stretch, and run into the sea to cool off. On the east side of the bay, Carlo Duarte is standing on a cliff looking out over the waters.
Hay una gran extensión de Posidonia oceánica de praderas submarinas.
Lots of seagrass grows here on the ocean floor. You know that because of the dark blue glassy water. Neptune grass is a CO2 filter. 1 hectare of seagrass emits 5 times more oxygen than a hectare of Amazon rainforest. How does that happen? Photosynthesis. Seaweed has a large biomass. Its leaves absorb the CO2 in the water. That causes the CO2 levels in the water to sink, and so more CO2 from the air can be taken into the water, which has been filtered by the seagrass.
Seagrass captures some 100 million tonnes of carbon around the world each year. That's as much as Germany emits over the course of 6 months. Here, in the Bay of Palma, the underwater meadow is made up of Posidonia oceanica, commonly known as Neptune grass. Seagrasses play a role in protecting our planet from the increasing build-up of carbon dioxide. They act as a carbon sink, absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which helps to slow down the effects of global warming.
It's important people know that this isn't algae, but a plant. This slow-growing plant is the oldest living creature on the planet. Seaweed is essential for our ecosystem and our entire society.
Seagrass is also home to many different kinds of wildlife. There are fish and snails hidden among the swaying blades. The grass also protects the coast against erosion, keeping Mallorca's beaches intact.
Sobre la pradera crecen muchos organismos.
Underwater, lots of organisms grow with a shell. The calcium particles from the shell reach the beach and regularly replenish the sand. If the seagrass is destroyed, the beaches would be destroyed. Mallorca would lose one of its most valuable treasures if the beaches were lost.
Seagrass also absorbs a lot of nutrient overload that runs into the sea from our farms and urban sewage. Researchers say each hectare of seagrass does the work of an entire sewage treatment plant. In recent years, seagrass meadows have started dying. We are losing them at a rate of about 3% a year. Enemy number one is climate change. Seagrass dies in warm water. Carlos Duarte believes the plant could die out altogether within the next 50 years. Tourism has done a lot to harm the seagrass meadows around the Balearic Islands. Boating is a popular sport here, but the ship anchors tear the grass out of the seafloor. Duarte points out where the damage has already become visible.
We're starting to see small areas of turquoise. Seagrass doesn't grow there anymore. The seafloor is just light sand.
After pressure from international ocean protection organisations, Balearian officials have finally reacted. For the past few months, there have been patrols in the water around Mallorca, where the seagrass grows.
Listen, here you cannot put the anchor. You must find the sand areas, because here the bottom, about the Posidonia, is protected from European laws. It's very important you don't leave the anchor in the plants.
Officials approach anyone who tries to lay anchor in the seagrass growing areas.
It's easy for you now. See, the, for example, here, the sand, no problem. Thank you very much.
There are now penalties in place as well. The maximum fine for destroying flora here is 450,000 euros. Carlos Duarte is urging locals and tourists to take better care of the plant life on the ocean floor.
We have to change our habits. If we don't, in 50 years' time, the sea will be a dirty, dark colour. No seagrass will grow and the water quality will be really bad.
Jesse Wingard, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Thank you to Stephanie Eichler for that report, which was read by Jesse Wingard.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say. It's all right. It's all right.
That's it for our show this week. If you're interested in more, you can visit us online at dwworld.de/environment. And if you want to keep up with the climate talks in Durban, you'll find lots of information on our climate page. I'm Saroja Coelho, and I'll be sitting in again for Nathan Witkop next week. From all of us here in Bonn, thanks for listening.
Little darling, it's been a long, cold and lonely winter. Little darling, it feels like years since you've been here. Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right. faces now. Little darling, it seems like years since you've been here. Little darling, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Little darling, feels like years since you've been here.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.